Hello, and welcome to Studio Sessions, the big red and shiny podcast where we talk with artists about the ideas, inspiration, and processes that go into their work. I'm your host, Matt Kuhlman, and my guest this episode is Andrew Zarew. Andrew earned a BA in Studio Art from Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts in 1994. His work typically involves collecting small fragments he encounters and including them into a new structure or configuration. Sometimes this is done by storing objects found on the sidewalk in glass jars, and other times by creating elaborate collages using found imagery. Join me as Andrew explains how these found images and objects capture his interest and his process of reconfiguring them into artwork. Andrew, how are you doing?
Pretty well, thank you.
Good to meet you, even though you're not a morning person for real this morning. So you mentioned when I got here that you grew up in Brooklyn. Do you want to talk a little bit about what your background was of growing up in this city and how you first got turned on to doing artwork?
Sure. Well, both of my parents are Brooklyn natives. I was raised along with my siblings in the neighborhood of Bay Ridge, which is one neighborhood south of where I am now. Mm-hmm. And I just remember that when it was time for me to go to college, I wanted to get as far away from New York City as I could. Not necessarily geographically, but culturally. I wanted to be in a more rural environment, and that's one of the reasons why I ended up in college in New England. Mm-hmm. But I ended up coming back towards the late 90s, almost by default after living in different parts of the country. But in terms of getting started in my involvement in art, I would say that it's kind of twofold. One of it has to do with the fact that I had pretty considerable dyslexia as a child growing up. So I kind of naturally gravitated towards anything that wasn't reading and writing. Mm. So music, sports, art, visual. Even at playing as a child, it was always very visual for me. Mm. But then I think the thing that kind of sealed the deal is that I have a sister who's 2.5 years older than me, and she's actually an art educator. She works with kids. Mm. And she was the person who really prompted me to be an artist and always gave me that encouragement. So I almost feel like if my sister hadn't encouraged me the way that she did, maybe I wouldn't have had the confidence or the interest in being an artist.
Mm-hmm. And at what point did you like make a actual decision to be like, I'm going to be an artist? Or
I think that happened, the transition from high school to college. In high school, I really was interested. I think I had three creative outlets or fantasies. You know, one was poetry, one was music, and one was visual art. But I had the opportunity to take some summer classes in upstate New York in between high school and college. And by the time I think what it was is that when I entered Hampshire College in 1990, I went in there thinking I was going to be a sculptor.
Mm-hmm.
And then a combination of events happened, and I realized by the end of my first year that I wanted to be a painter.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, although I'm not painting per se, there was no real going back. Although the music making actually did come back in college, and it was a priority for about 10 years out of school, but I never stopped making 2D work.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of sculpture, I did see on your site that you have a very long-running project of collecting things in jars, and they're over on the shelf right there.
About half of them.
That's been going since like 1995, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess what started that and what keeps it going, and what kind of things are you collecting here?
Okay, yeah, that was something. So when I left New England in 94, I was playing music, and the band that I was a part of left the Northeast for the Southeast, and I ended up living for a year and a half in Athens, Georgia. And there was about a 2-mile trek between where I was living and the downtown where I had a job. And sometimes I would drive, sometimes I'd ride my bike, but sometimes I would just walk. And I think it was just from walking around Athens, that's where it started. I just, little things would kind of catch my eye. And sometimes I wonder in terms of, you know, is it the angle that I hold my head that allows me to see these things, or is it that, like, I'm holding my head at this angle because I'm constantly looking for stuff, like scanning the ground as opposed to looking to the horizon or up. Yeah. But mostly it was just finding things that I didn't know what they were, and it became like these little riddles or puzzles. And actually the first things that I started collecting were the weights that go on tires for balancing. But I didn't know what they were, and it took about a year or so of collecting these things and then showing them to people and then getting the answer. And that happened again here too in New York City, where I was collecting these long rusted bits of metal that turned out to be the actual bristles for the street cleaners. But I would see them everywhere, but I had no idea where they were coming from. It's kind of curious. So it was really just about curiosity and seeing these things that are mostly overlooked, that to me seemed compelling or interesting because I didn't have a definition for them. And now it's a little bit broader than that, but it's a combination. There's not much in the way of organic material. It's mostly plastic or metal, some things that are reflective.
I can see some like fishing bobbers in there.
Yeah, sometimes some of those things are things that actually like people will just leave out in a kind of like a garbage pile or a box, like a free giveaway pile. And then some of them are really just things that are just, you know, in the gutter.
Yeah.
That I stop and pick up. It was one of those things that in the late 90s they actually started going into these jars. And then had them in my apartment on a shelf, and friends would usually take an interest to them and say how much they appreciated them. But I never thought of them as art with a capital A.
Yeah.
It was just something kind of more personal or hobbyish. And then, due to something I was doing a few years back with collage materials and organizing collage materials, a parallel was drawn between these pouches that were holding almost like notebooks for potential collages, and then these jars. Something about the container and the kind of like gentle chaos inside, that the way things kind of relate and fall in with each other, just physically, visually. I realized that these things were closer to my practice than I was maybe giving credit to. So it took a while actually for me to actually integrate them into my, like, I guess what I'm trying to say is that if it was 1995 or 1996, I wouldn't have put that on my website.
Yeah.
It took a while for me to feel comfortable with having that on.
You have like a display of these before though, like in a gallery setting, right? Or did you just kind of document it that way?
I've only shown them twice, and in both times I've shown them, it was very different. And I'm just hoping that as time goes on and the collection keeps on going, that I'll have other opportunities to kind of rearticulate, represent the work. But the last time they were shown was actually in a doorway space on a shelving unit that didn't have a back to it. And what was behind the doorway was kind of a like a boiler room, and so inside that room we set up a bunch of floodlights, and then on the backing of the shelving unit was just a thin sheet of glassine, which is translucent but it's also not clear. So you just get this wall of light behind the jars.
And the practice of a
going and finding things and picking them up relates a lot to, I saw you had a lot of photos that you take with your cell phone, and you kind of described a similar process where it's just a moment where you'll be walking down the street and something will stand out to you and you'll capture it quickly with your cell phone.
Yeah, they're really related. I sometimes ask myself, like, what's the difference between these two things? And I think that with the cell phone pictures, maybe it's more about a relationship. Sometimes it's things that are like architectural or even landscape-ish on a larger scale that I'm not going to be able to put something in my pocket, so to speak, like the objects in the jars. But it's the same sort of situation where I'm out in the world and I'm going through the checklist of my day in terms of errands or responsibilities and things I need to do, and then there's this sudden snap or pop and suddenly I'm in a different place mentally. It kind of heightens my own self-awareness. I'm in the world and there's this almost like a signal or a sign that's catching my attention.
I noticed that a lot of them have like objects, like pairs or two of something.
Do you mean in the cell phone?
Yeah, in the images that you were taking pictures of.
Relationships of two?
There'd be like a picture of two of those orange road triangles or like
the pylon.
Two like cracks in a wall or something. I don't know. But was that?
I didn't
see that many pictures, like, because I only had so much time to look through them, and I'm sure there's like thousands if you've been doing this for how long did you start doing it?
Yeah, I think, if my memory's correct, I think it was around 2007 that I finally acquired a cell phone with camera. I think I'd had a cell phone for a couple years prior. I'm very much a Luddite. Definitely not a first generation cell phone carrier. So I think it was around 2007 that I started taking these pictures. And in terms of, you make me want to research my own portfolio and see and investigate that. I wasn't aware of the relationship of twos. That's something that sometimes I think about with collages, where I'll deliberately, almost like an algorithm, like set up a restriction. That I'm going to just try to make a piece that's about the relationship of two or three pieces. But I hadn't really thought about that with the cell phone pics.
With the pictures that you're taking, like, what do you end up doing with them? Do you just kind of stockpile them for future use, or do you sift through them ever to draw out imagery?
There's definitely a stockpile. It's definitely, there's, as time goes on, much like the jars, there is this accumulation that happens, and sometimes that can be daunting in terms of, I don't have enough time, or mostly it becomes an issue of time in terms of digging things up and rehashing what preceded. But in terms of what I've done with them, I was trying to make books, and I did make a couple of books, although they weren't quite what I would have liked to have made. And that came actually down to money and budget in terms of production. But I just see it really as note taking, and that sometimes it can be really specific in terms of walking by a construction site and something's happening with where I am in relationship to this, and we've all seen it. I don't have the proper name for it, but the netting that's used usually to kind of catch debris or just to line between the building and the sidewalk. And there's different types of that. But then sometimes I'll be working with either sculpture or with collage perforated netted material. And it's simply, sometimes it's just simply that. It's just that sort of relationship of kind of A to A. This is what I'm thinking about. But more often than not, it's not really that literal to me. It's more visual and just impressionistic. I just will see things that are surprising relationships that I don't even have an answer for it while I'm in the moment. It's usually kind of later afterwards and looking at things as a whole that you start to tease out trends.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned working like kind of algorithmically, and that was in one piece. It was an algorithmic stencil drawing, or there's a series of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess use that as a jumping point to start talking about that work and what the method is that you're, what kind of limitations are you giving yourself for?
Okay, yeah, that if I can. Trying to be precise with my chronology, I think those pieces were around 2008, and I was looking for a way into serial process, because up until that point, 2004, 2005, 6, 7, it was way more organic and intuitive in terms of making work. And it was interesting because I would have friends come over and do studio visits, and to them the work read as a cohesive body, but for me it seemed too scattered or too unrelated, that I was really feeling kind of anxious or concerned that I was just shooting in the dark, and I felt like I needed a stricter process or almost proposal that would keep me in line, or keep let's just see if I can make like a real cohesive body.
Mm.
So up until that point, it had mostly been either collage or water-based paints on paper, or a combination, like a hybrid of the two.
Mm.
I hadn't really done much in the way of just straight up drawing, or I had prior, but it had been a while. So I, at this time, I had all these stencils that sometimes I would use very, very, very infrequently, just for little projects. But then I just thought, oh wait, maybe this could be a gateway into a project. And I set up very simple rules in terms of the relationship of the stencil to the paper in terms of edges, and then also filling in the negative spaces, the shapes. I have all these. I mean, I can pull them out if you're interested, but there are all these architectural stencils I have over there, and some of the shapes get very, very elaborate and also hyper-specific, things that you couldn't really mistake for anything else. I was going for more of a kind of open-ended, simple geometry, diamonds, triangles, rectangles, circles, hexagrams, things like that. So then I would also just set up these rules in terms of, you know, once I would have a stencil in place, the picture, the paper underneath gradually would fill up to the point where I wouldn't allow myself to use a stencil unless there was enough space for two shapes per plastic stencil. I don't know if this makes any sense. It makes sense to me. I just don't know if it translates verbally.
On a sheet, there's like several the stencil designs, and if there's room for two of them.
At least two. At least two, but if the paper was filling up and wouldn't accommodate at least two shapes per stencil, then I would just go on to the next stencil for those options, or I would, at some point the paper gets maxed out and there's less and less options, and then it's done, yeah. You know? And it's just interesting that you even brought that up, just because this was something that I had done a while ago as a stencil for spray painting. This is from a few years ago, and I just keep on pulling it out because part of me wants this to be done as a piece as itself, but then part of me also feels like it's lacking or I need to do something else with it. And recently I was at the Whitney and I bought, they sell photogram paper.
Mm-hmm.
And so these are just from last week. I was just playing around with, this is almost the same effect that I would get with the drawings or the spray painting, but through a different process.
An easy cyanotype paper where you just leave it out and then rinse it.
Exactly.
Cool.
Yeah. So, but with this northern winter light, I remember the instructions were for leaving it out for like 3 to 5 minutes,
mm-hmm.
and I think I had to leave things out for more 3 hours.
Yeah.
but anyways, I'm still curious about possibly doing more with these.
Mm-hmm. And that seems to relate directly to your larger body of work, which you have stuff flying around, where it seems like you're drawing from a lot of different sources and like chopping things up modularly and then replacing them into a new design or a...
Yeah, I think a lot of that correlates to what I was telling you before about the dyslexia.
Mm-hmm.
Because dyslexia is something that I actually never really researched until this summer. And I was reading this book that talks a lot about disorientation, and that dyslexia primarily can be a reading issue, but it can also become manifest in other ways in terms of just spatial relationships.
Mm.
And I think that, I mean, I'm not trying to say that I'm any, because I read a book, that I have any sort of authority. So, but in terms of my own understanding, I think it has a lot to do with feelings of disorientation and then trying to re-articulate things in a way that actually not necessarily ground, but I guess exemplify that disorientation, but in a good way, as opposed to something that's a vulnerable way or insecure way.
Mm-hmm.
It's more of a an openness. Like, this is what things feel like most of the time. Does that make sense?
I guess so.
But it's like an anagram, you know, like in terms of taking a word and scrambling the letters. I feel like a lot of what I'm doing with my collage process is scrambling.
Mm-hmm.
It's taking a sequence, breaking it, shuffling the components, and finding kind of the right kind of tension between something that feels still insecure and then maybe something that's vibrating in a chaotic way.
Mm-hmm. Where do you come up with some of your compositions? Because some of them are like very geometric, like the one behind you there's got a lot of circles and triangles and diamonds.
Is this one? Wait, which one?
That one.
Or this one right here?
Yeah.
Right.
And then some of them are very freeform, like that one on the wall.
Yeah. Well, this is a pretty good example of just where I am right now, because my process sometimes, like, I think a lot of artists are like this, that sometimes they work specific, they will get serial, or they will work, let's say, for a project or an exhibition, And then if those things are not necessary, they can simply just play. I know that that's not all artists, but I am definitely somebody who, I don't really like to get locked into too tight. I feel like I play within a certain field or parameter, but then within that there's a good amount of difference. And so with this top piece, which is something I only made maybe 5 or 6 weeks ago, mm-hmm. I to kind of go back to the source of the whole thing. I mean, on one hand, the first step in all of this is really collecting, in terms of acquiring the impulse to go through somebody's recycling pile for paper, or to go to a thrift store and walk out with bags of books and magazines and stuff like that. So there's that, and then there becomes the editing process of cutting, separating, organizing, and that's where these portfolios in here all kind of filled with different sorts of paper in different ways, and the pouches then become almost like chapters within a book.
Yeah. I see over here you have stacks of similar pattern designs,
right,
all cut into diamonds, so you can just kind of draw which one.
Yeah, it's basically
in a slot, I guess.
Yeah, it's basically a palette, you know. And so with this piece, I think what was happening was that I was in the process of doing some organizing of the material, and what I started seeing was this trend of both landscape and architectural forms that were photographic, coming from things like National Geos and encyclopedias that were probably, you know, mid-century, 50s, 60s, 70s, maybe early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
The palette does something kind of specific. I mean, there's a different sort of printing process that they used back then, so there's a different color sensibility. But it was all kind of built around this kind of washed out, bluish, grayish, brownish palette with these sometimes deliberate, what I would call like the A form, which is the something like a satellite dish or sets of umbrellas,
yeah,
or
something recognizable.
Something. And, but then what normally happens is that when I'm doing this, the cast off, the part that I'm cutting away, sometimes becomes equally or more interesting than, so like the B part becomes actually more compelling or curious to me than the A part. So I would end up just saving all this material, and that's actually that was the first. Behind you is a second. That's pretty, actually it's pretty minimal piece. There's only seven. It's 6 feet long, and there's only 7 pieces of paper on it. And then there's this one, which is 8 feet long on Mylar, and it's still not there yet. It's gonna, I think it's a few sessions away from being done. I need to do some more collecting. But in terms of this, then yeah, this gets into the more kind of strict algorithmic diamond grid, also built up on color and formal relationships. But this one is actually more recent. This is just within the last week or so. And I wanted to do something different than just... This was actually the first thing I thought of this morning. I just threw this down because it was originally on that piece. The circles came in recently. I had to buy a new compass for this. But I was just trying to think of a way of keeping the grid, but then again scrambling the grid in terms of turning certain forms, just turning the dial, and then turning some back again in the opposite way. So this is still kind of new to me. This is generally new too, and I don't know. This one to me just feels very, it just feels like a big sketch. It's about not thinking. It's really kind of about not thinking too hard. It's about just working kind of intuitively and quickly, and it's about a certain kind of lack of control, at least in terms of composition. I mean, the cutting is very deliberate.
Yeah.
These are A little less so. These are more considered on a slow. It's a slower process, slower rhythm.
Mm.
And I think that for me, I think that's just what I need in terms of being here in New York and kind of. I operate on different speeds. You know, I have my manic New York City freelance, you know, existence, and then I sometimes have to deliberately unplug myself from that and operate in a different, almost like in a different time zone.
Mm-hmm.
So
how long have you been working in this method of kind of collecting different print material, scrambling it and collaging it?
Long time.
Okay. That's longest running body, I guess, then.
Yeah, I think the first time I ever made collages was actually in high school. So this preceded my formal education as a painter, which was very traditional in terms of landscape painting in the landscape and then formal abstraction in the studio. So what had preceded this was being in high school, loving music, and being aware of the mixtape.
Mm-hmm.
And I would very, very regularly, it was one of my favorite things to do, was to arrange, sequence music, and then make these one-of-a-kind kind of original hand-packaged covers for these tapes. And then that became, over time, those became mixed CDs.
Yeah.
And then it was something that I always felt. I think I resisted collage for a long time because I thought of it in this vernacular of of kind of high school hobbyish endeavor, or kind of a certain maybe like suspended adolescence. And
yeah,
I didn't.
It's probably a lot of art professors that wouldn't encourage it, I guess.
Yeah, but you know what? I think what's happened for me in terms of the last 5 or 6 years is that there's been a breaking down of these kind of supposed or assumed rules that, like the jars, the cell phone pictures, collage material. I even did a project this year where I was sending music out to people once a week, making this mix over the course of a year via email. I think all of this stuff is about putting, and this isn't a narcissistic thing, it's more about breaking down assumptions, but putting more of me into the work,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to thinking that it has to be this other thing, kind of more kind of starchy,
mm-hmm.
And uptight. I feel like I've been relaxing the rules of engagement for me to actually, like, what I can include in my work.
Mm.
So, does that...
Yeah, that's good. Right now it's kind of like an installation on a rooftop, and
right.
there's like similar aesthetic and process, so it seemed, but it's such different materials.
Yeah, these pieces, they're actually a lot of what's here, and then some of the stuff is actually stacked up over there.
Okay.
But about a year ago, I had been doing these sculpture pieces that I was doing over in this section of my studio, and the components were either these stick sculptures or that are actually fixed and adhere with adhesive and wire, and then the other components are actually, nothing is actually fixed. It's these glass containers that come from these Hispanic, like the bodegas down on Fifth Avenue, they sell candles. And so I'll burn the candles, use the candles, and then keep the glass jars. Mm-hmm. Jars are filled with either red or orange, both shopping bags that are very common in my neighborhood here on 8th Avenue. Then these pieces here, these flat perforated pressboard pieces, are actually the bottoms of clementine boxes, which they also sell. Well, they sell all over the city, but they're very ubiquitous over here. Mm-hmm. So it's basically wood, glass, plastic, spray paint. This is the only thing that I actually bought. This was something I got upstate in a junk shop for a couple bucks, and I still don't know what it is, this wooden...
Yeah, it's like a weird kind of spearhead coming up.
Yeah, it's that thing right there. It's a very... I even asked the woman at the store what it was, and she said that she had no idea. So I got it for $2 because it looked... like it needed to be part of this. And then these sections over here that are kind of triangular are, I'm assuming they're probably poplar or some cedar, some sort of cheap wood, but they come from the corners of the clementine boxes. And so last winter, I was really, really excited about this because up until this point, I really hadn't done a lot of sculptures. A lot of the work had been 2D, and I had nothing really hanging over my head. I had the time to play and kind of try new things. And what I realized, actually, kind of midstream, it wasn't apparent to me right away, was that a lot of this reminded me of being a kid, mm-hmm. in terms of being 8 or 9 or 10 years old in my bedroom at my parents' house. And the way I would organize, whether it was marbles or Legos or whatever the heck it was that I was playing with, mm-hmm. but I was very, like we were talking about before, in terms of spatial sensitivities and disorientation, it was all about kind of like setting up these rules. And this is as an 8-year-old or seven, mm-hmm. nobody taught me how to engage this way or play this way, but I remember that when I was just last year sitting here as a 41-year-old man, this weird time-space thing happened where I realized I'm kind of doing something very similar to what I did as a child.
Yeah,
and that was actually it wasn't intentional. It was just life kind of repeating itself.
I think I kind of did the same thing where when I was a kid, I would have all of my toys out of the toy box and on the floor because that way I could see like what I had, and if I saw it, then I'd want to play with it. But if it was in the box, I just like forgot about it. So my mom would be like, "Why don't you ever use your toy box?" I'm like, I can't see what I got if it's in the box. when I work in the studio, like I go through and like have to clean up after huge projects, but that's how I keep my materials. I'll be doing a lot of mixed media things, and I'll have like the colored pencil pile and like gouache and acrylics, and they all have to be out because if they're in the box up in the closet or something,
like, out of sight, out of
mind. I just don't even consider using it. So
that makes sense. Yeah, that makes sense.
Strong parallels.
this piece actually inhabited this half of my studio floor for the better part of a year. And the only people that really saw it were friends that came either specifically for a studio visit or were just coming over, randomly. And all these same components, there's almost 20 of them. It actually really depends. I feel like there's a certain kind of play in terms of which ones are allowed to be part of this and which ones aren't. But they were set up on the floor. Actually, I think I have a photo on my studio page of what it kind of looked like for a while. I think there's a couple there. So yeah, here down here on the floor is kind of how things were for a while. And then I just knew for a long, long time, I think since the summer, that they needed to be on the roof to be documented. Mm. And I don't know. I just procrastinated, I guess, for a while. It took me a while to actually take things up to the roof and do the photography. But when I did, I was really, really excited. I still need to get back up there and do either a second or third round. But it was definitely transformative in terms of how they read here in this interior, and then taking them upstairs out into the open air on this big, well, relatively big expanse. It's something that I don't even know if I can fully articulate it, because it still feels fresh, but it feels really important to me. That situation, that relationship felt freer than what was in here.
So if you're going to display them for like gallery purposes, do you think that would be the ideal, is to have them on the open air somewhere? Or
I think so, in terms of maybe if it was for a shorter exhibition. I don't see these things as having a lot of integrity for the elements.
In the weather part,
they would
not do so well.
They would break down pretty quickly. So you know, if it was a one day or a weekend exhibition sort of installation, sure. And you know, assuming it's not snowing or raining, or you know,
I was wondering like if the piece exists more in the documentation of it or in the actual physical seeing it out there, because you have the pictures that show it in, on the roof up there. So
yeah, that's a really good point. I've been kind of grilling myself about this too, because to me on the roof, and the title, I've actually now titled like Rooftop as part of the title. I've never made work before that the documentation becomes the primary object or thing. So again, that might be something that I have to just warm up to. But I would, you know, it isn't to say that I wouldn't put them in a gallery, in an interior gallery space. I would, you know, considering the space, if it seemed like a right fit, I would totally do that. But I think you're onto something there about the photography being maybe the primary vehicle for the piece.
Well, I'm about out of questions for you, and I think we've covered most of your work that I'm aware of. Is there anything you wanted to touch on before we go?
No, because I'm still waking up, so I don't know if I have.
You're pretty well for being half awake.
Half awake, yeah. No, but I just want to say thank you. This is it's been a pleasure.
Yeah.
So I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for being with me.
Yeah.
And that concludes this episode of Studio Sessions with our guest Andrew Zaru. You can find his work online at andrewzaru.net. You can also learn more about me on my website, mattkuhlman.com. If you'd like to support this program, you can send a donation through PayPal to studiosessionspodcast@gmail.com. Even if you only send $1, your donation helps guarantee I can continue providing interviews with interesting artists for your listening pleasure. And of course, don't forget to visit bigredandshiny.com for future episodes, along with other high-quality arts and culture content. Thank you for listening, and see you next time on Studio Sessions.